just kind of get us started in your life. Tell us a little bit about where you grew up and how you grew up, maybe siblings, parents. Talk to us a little bit about the beginnings of Dolores.
Okay.
And what is your maiden name?
Briski.
Briski. I think
yes,
I knew that. But
I am
Dolores Briski.
Second generation Croatian. So my great grandparents came over from Croatia. So I am one quarter Croatian. Briski. Yes. Okay. I brought just a couple of pictures to share. This is where I started. These are my parents, Danetta and Larry. My mom turned 19 2 months before this picture was taken, and my dad just turned 20 a month before they were married. So they were babies, very, very young. I was born in Alton, Illinois, which is right across the river from St. Louis. Very refinery, right on the river, so lots of, it wasn't, when people think of Illinois, it's not Chicago, and it wasn't cornfields that I grew up in, like I was right there on the river, so it was a lot of refinery and things like that.
Midwestern sensibilities.
Very Midwestern. So let's see, where do I start? So I have one sister. I'm the oldest of all the people in my family. And I have one sister. She was born 3 years after I was born. And we all lived in this sweet little tiny house in Illinois. And when I was 5 years old, I finished kindergarten, and my parents decided to move to Little Rock, Arkansas. So we lived there for a year. My dad went to law school. Well, actually, he finished his undergrad there, and he started law school. My mom worked at an orthodontist as a receptionist, as an orthodontist. And I was 6 years old and had already been to kindergarten, and at the time in Arkansas, kindergarten started when you were in sixth grade, so I had like this big break year. Like I was free, I didn't go to school, I just hung out.
My gap year
when I was six. It was really, really great. While we lived in Arkansas, my parents decided to separate. So my grandfather drove from Illinois to Little Rock, and he came and picked up my sister and my mom and me, and we went back to live where we were. We lived with my grandparents for a while. My parents ended up divorcing, and my dad stayed in Arkansas. Then I finished growing up for the most part in Illinois, Southern Illinois, and would visit him in the summers and kind of spent time split between them like that.
Yeah. How did that affect you from that age, like, say, beginning of, before they were divorced to after? How did that sort of affect your psyche, I guess, more than your geography?
So the very interesting thing about my parents is they were divorced when I was young, and only one time in my entire life do I ever remember them arguing. So if you can have a really good divorce, my parents figured out how to navigate that. Like never once did I ever hear them speak poorly of each other. Never once did they ever make me feel anything other than loved and cherished and all of the things that you want your parents to feel. So I'm sure there's some trauma or something there, but like it really, I was turned out to be a daddy's girl, and I only spent the summers with him. So I'd say probably like my little internal self was like, I want to spend more time with my dad, and it's not really fair that I don't get more time with my dad. And now that I've had children and I think back on what my mother did, like this is 1971, y'all. So like she's supporting two little girls and working and doing all these things and so freely sending us to, like putting us on an airplane. My sister was three and I was six, and we'd get on an airplane and fly to Arkansas. And ultimately my dad remarried and moved to Texas. But just like, how she did that now as a mom, I'm like, I don't understand.
Yeah, well, I'm going to go off script just a little bit, but tell us what they're doing now. And I know it's a lot of that is it takes up a great deal of capacity and time for you right now, but talk to us a little bit about what your parents
like kind of
are
what they're going
now.
Through right now. Yeah. So in the last year, my dad has been diagnosed with dementia. His mother had Alzheimer's, and it was horrible. She had early onset. And so from the time she was 50, she struggled with that. And I remember the very last time we saw her, she had been, you know, in a facility for so long and was no longer eating or anything and just really vacant. And my dad has carried that for a long time, thinking that's the very worst thing that ever could happen to anybody. And so his transitioning and coming into this stage where he's realizing this is what's happening to him. It's been really hard, and he's been amazing. He has been so, just positive about it, at the same time realizing how sad and terminal it is. That's kind of something we're working through.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, talk to us, I guess, into your youth. What kind of kid were you? What kind of student were you? Were you drawn to any particular subjects? I can imagine you probably were. and who made an impact on you during that time? Was there a particular teacher or friend that kind of drew you out a little bit more?
So I am the oldest firstborn, and I am like as stereotypical firstborn as you can possibly be. So I could only make good grades. I could only follow all the rules. I could only do all of those things. So I loved school, and I loved math, and I loved science. Sixth grade, Mr. Mayberry was my sixth grade science teacher, and it was in sixth grade that I decided I loved Marie Curie and that I would absolutely be a physicist, and that was my plan. And I had a little chemistry set in my basement, and it was my favorite thing to do. It's like, oh, I just felt so grown up and adult and very scientific. I loved it so much.
You think there's something about how you grew up and just through all of it, finding something that you're really interested in, again, with your family, something that you feel like you can empathize with the kids that are under your charge kind of now, that you really kind of connect to that time that you went through? Is there anything like that?
I don't know. That's such a good question. I think, I just remember what it was like to be a kid, and some days are really hard, and some days your life isn't like what you think everybody thinks it should be like. And really just that, probably more than anything, that sense of, am I important, and do I make a difference? And all, in those years, my friends and I started a singing telegram company. We had matching little outfits, and people could pay us to go do singing telegrams. And this, it was really good. I could still do it for y'all right now if you wanted me to, but I probably won't. But just thinking about how you felt, not like a kid and childish, but that you always felt like there, you had something to contribute, or you could see yourself as being older. And so you were kind of important in that way. Does that make sense?
Yeah, that's really interesting. It's very insightful, because when you're a kid, you don't go around saying, hey, I'm just a kid with an undeveloped brain, right?
Right. I'm not capable of doing. This is what I am.
Yeah,
right. Exactly.
That's really cool. Well, talk to us about sort of that next stage. What led you? I know you're Aggie, Texas A&M.
Yes, I am.
What led you out to I guess come down south to Texas A&M, and tell us what that was like?
So one of my many character flaws is that I think I like to do things that are really hard, whether that's a good idea or not. And so if it's hard, I'm attracted to it. So in sixth grade, I decided I wanted to be a physicist. By the time I was in high school, I realized physicists don't make very much money. And so money's kind of important. Not that my family ever had very much money, so maybe that's why I realized it. But so I decided instead I'll be an engineer, because I thought I'd make a little more money as an engineer than I would as a physicist. So my father had moved from Arkansas to Texas, and I spent every summer with him, and I loved Texas. I hate cold weather. I don't like snow. I don't like anything about the North. And so it was just very natural for me to want to come to Texas. Also, in part of my parents' agreement when they divorced, my dad, this may or may not be legal, I don't know, but he claimed me on his income tax, and my mom claimed my sister. So the reason I'm sharing that with you is that I could get in-state tuition in Texas, or I could get in-state tuition in Illinois for college. And so that was a no-brainer. I'm going to go to Texas and live. So again, nothing at all like my daughter's college preparation experiences at all. I didn't look at any schools. I didn't take the SAT. I didn't do all of the things that everybody does now. I took the ACT because that was the thing that you did in Illinois, and Texas A&M didn't take the ACT at that time. So what I ended up doing was living with my father and my stepmother and my little sisters and going to Tarleton State University, which was part of the A&M system. It's in Stephenville, Texas, outside of Fort Worth, if y'all know where that is. And I've talked about that school before. It was very, very, very Texan. The largest group on campus was the rodeo club, and they were not fond of Yankees. I'll just leave it at that.
You're not welcome.
I was not welcome. And it was really, really hard 2 years. Honestly, it was a 45-minute drive back and forth every day from my dad's house. I worked full-time because I had no money. Nobody in my family had any money. And so I made it, though. I did 2 years there. So let me go back. So when I decided what kind of engineering to do, I thought I have to do the hardest engineering. So that's either, in my brain, it's either nuclear or aerospace. And I decided I fly in airplanes a lot, so why not aerospace? Y'all, these are all of the worst reasons to ever decide to do anything. Like, I would be mortified if my daughters thought this was a plan to get into college. But it's the plan that I followed, and it worked for
it
me.
It sort of worked out.
I think it sort of worked out.
Well, and so you end up at NASA.
Yes.
How does that happen to kind of on a whim? I'm going to be aerospace engineering, and now you're at NASA doing amazing things. Talk to us about sort of the details of your professional path at NASA. Where did you start? What did you work on? Who did you meet? That kind of thing. Talk to us about what you did at NASA.
Can I back up just a tiny bit? So my college years were the dark years for me. For my whole family, everything was awful. My mother was diagnosed with melanoma. My father was divorced for the third time and kept my sister in the agreement and gave everything else away. So he and my little sister literally had no refrigerator. Like, they were eating out of an ice chest. They had nothing. My mother is going through her third divorce, and he was a terrible, abusive man. And she had no, like, none of us. It was all really, really terrible. I am stubborn also. I don't know if y'all know that about me, but I'm also stubborn. So, like, I'm going to graduate with an aerospace engineering degree no matter how hard or how long it took me. So 6 years later, with a 2.00, like, stretch those O's, I graduate with an aerospace engineering degree from Texas A&M University. Literally, my whole family was on their way down from Illinois for my graduation, and I was in one of my professor's offices saying, you have to give me a C because I have a job, and my parents, everyone is coming for graduation. Will you please give me a C so I can graduate from this university? So, like, oof. And, like, resilience and grit. That's, like, I got it in spades from my time there. So I say all that to say I had one job offer. Just one. Turns out that's all you need. And it was with NASA. So it all, again, worked out pretty okay for me. It was actually with United Space Alliance. They were Rockwell at the time. They were just starting the International Space Station program, which wasn't even called that at the time. It was this brand new program. And they needed a bunch of new hires with engineering degrees to come stand up their training division, their operations where their flight controllers worked, those divisions. And so they were hiring a lot of people, which was great for me. So I got that job offer. When I interviewed for the job, they asked me lots of things about my grades and about all my work because I put myself through school and had 1,000 different jobs. One of the places I worked was kinder care, taking care of little bitty children. And they said, you know, this is interesting on your resume. Turns out astronauts and kindergartners are quite similar. So you've bringing some good experience with you that, you know, we can see how that will apply. And it was true. That was true. So I got the one job. I said, I graduate on this day. What's the soonest day you will hire me? Because I really would like a paycheck. So I was actually the first person to start working for Rockwell in that particular contract. Started on June 4th, and it was a training division, and it was like the best job, second to this job. Literally, it was so amazing. My job at the first few years, because the space station program wasn't stood up yet, so was just like learning about the program, learning about the hardware, what the testing, all of that was. And then they would expect us to turn around and teach other people. So one of the things I did was I went through this instructor training course that we brought in Air Force Academy instructors to teach some of us how to teach other people. So that's one of the things I did early on before we had somebody set up. And then I would go into a classroom and it would be filled with astronauts and like all these people who, you know, had flown on shuttle, who'd flown in Apollo, all of these things. And it, can you imagine, I'm like 24 and I have nothing, right? Like I have my little piece of paper that says I graduated from Texas A&M, but I have no, like nothing. And they're like, just go in there and teach them about this program. Stand in front of a classroom of all these people. So somehow I made my way through that and did that as well. And we kind of learned the program together. It was a really great time because there were so many people my age that they brought in, and none of us knew anything, but people get married then and we just grow so close, you know, like everybody starts dating and just having babies together and wedding showers. Is it was a family, but a family of a couple hundred, you know.
And turned out you met someone as well.
I did. I met this guy.
Yeah, talk to us about Steve.
So Steve Rader worked down the hall from me.
What did he do? And was he known for something especially?
Yeah, exactly. So this is how it all worked. We were all of us people, there's a couple hundred of us, and most of them are in their 20s, right? We're just all out of college. And they put us all in this building off-site because there wasn't enough room on-site yet for all of us. So, like, there's bosses, and then there's just 20-year-olds everywhere. And the proportion of women to men, you can imagine, was a little lopsided. So probably one woman and 20 men in this building. And again, we're all 20. So the second day I'm there, like, here comes, apparently this is a tradition, here comes all a bunch of guys all to introduce themselves to the new women engineer at the in the building. And so one of those guys turns out to be Steve Rader. And a few weeks later, he comes into my office and he says, listen, no, excuse me, that's not how it goes. Here's how it goes. We, all the new people go through this at the time. We all went through this like 6-week, I think it was, training program. And they teach you all about NASA, and it's just this very introductory thing. And each class has someone who organizes a big party at the end of the session, right? So, of course, it is my job. It would have been Margaret Rankin's job at the time had she been there. But it was my job to organize this big party for the class when we graduate. And so they said, there's one guy that always gets invited to each of these parties. His name is Steve Rader. You'll need to go down and invite him to this party. I said, okay, great. Why is it that I'm inviting him? Well, Steve Rader, when he finished, he started about a year before me. When he finished this course and he was at the party, he was told that it was tradition to go up to Gene Kranz. Everybody knows who Gene Kranz is, right? To walk up to Gene Kranz, to shake his hand and rub his head for good luck. Steve Rader believed this to be the truth and actually did it. And therefore, he gets invited to each of these parties. So it was my job to invite Steve Rader to the party. So this was kind of our second meeting. And a year later, we started dating. Yeah.
And I know I'm skipping over a lot, but tell us about, at some point, you're married and you begin to have a family.
I do.
And I want you to talk to us a little bit about your kids, about Anna and Abby and Lauren. What each one of them is doing now, and maybe a little bit about something you've learned from each of them, given their personalities.
Oh, gosh.
And do we have pictures of them?
Oh, we do. Yes. Sorry. Okay.
Not Here that you go. Don't know who they
no,
are, but.
But just in case. Whoops. Hang on. Oh, wait, I got to show you this. Hey, Brad, how do I make it not be on screen, on the screensaver? Oh, I'm reconnected. Okay. We got it. Okay. That was us here, y'all. Oh. Okay, so these are my girls when I started. This is how little they were when I started working at South Main Baptist Church. So the oldest is Anna. Anna is now 21. She is graduating this May from the College of William and Mary. Her college experience has been exactly 100% opposite, 180 degrees opposite of mine, and that was a big prayer of mine. She is going to get a degree in neuroscience, and her her minor is in economics. She is deciding right now what she wants to do after she graduates, whether it's grad school or getting a job or doing a PhD program. I don't know. I don't know what she's going to do. Anna, like me, is very stereotypical first child. Her favorite thing to do in the world is to make up rules. When she was little, she would get all her cousins together and they would play a game, and she would spend so much time developing and explaining the rules that nobody wanted to play the game by the time she finally got to through with all of the rules. That is very Anna Rader. Another thing that is very Anna Rader is she is maybe the kindest human that I know. Like, she has a heart that is so big and just sees the best in every single person she meets. Not too long ago, we were in Nashville and we were walking down the street and a homeless man came up and asked something. And I responded in the pastoral way that I am used to responding and kind of went on my way. And I look back and Anna is still there carrying on a conversation with this gentleman and then is going to go run down the street to buy him some food, chases him down the street to make sure he gets this food, and just has like this whole, like, she just sees the best in every person and the way that God sees them, I think. And that's just kind of beautiful for her. Abby is that little tiny one in the middle. Abby is a freshman at the University of Texas. Y'all remember where I got my degree? I'm doing fine with it. I'm doing fine. I have one mug that is orange and it says Mother of a Longhorn. And I have one t-shirt that says Longhorn Mom. I said, these are the only two things I will own. And they are very clearly delineating my relationship with this university because I can't. She is studying architecture there and it is so perfect for her. Abby is ever since she's been tiny, like, I've never met a human who was so confident and comfortable with who they are. Like, if you don't like what she's doing, it's okay. It doesn't bother her. She's just like, I am who I am, and I'm happy who I am, and she's just so laid back, like nothing ruffles her. My prayer before she was born is that whatever child, like this second child, would not be overwhelmed by Anna Rader. She has a pretty, right, like a pretty big presence in a little tiny person, and Abby was the perfect child. Like, that was an answered prayer that she is just like, whatever, you know, it's all good. And then she surprises you and gets into the architecture school at University of Texas, which is really, really hard to do. And so she's just sweet. She loves, I was just talking to her the other day and she's like, I just finished reading Exodus. I feel like I didn't read the Bible enough while I was living at home. I'm like, okay, that's really good. I don't know. But she's doing great there. And then the youngest is Lauren, who is now a sophomore in, no, she's a junior, y'all. She's a junior in high school, so I have one more year after this with her. She is on the dance team there, and she is, like, had no, like, she didn't do dance all her life, and so she's worked really hard and stuck with it, which makes me really happy. One of the things that Steve and I have talked about is, like, we both had these lives that made, like, gave you plenty of opportunities to develop your grit and your resilience. And these sweet babies, like, they really haven't had hard things in their life. And so it was a prayer for all of them that, like, you figure this out and commit to stuff and work hard. And so it looks different. It's not, it didn't look at all like it did for me, for Lauren, but, like, really working hard. And she goes to school at 5:45 every morning, y'all, and dances for 2 hours to start her day. And then 2 days a week, she stays after. And every other Saturday, they work about 6 hours. Like, it is a huge commitment, and it's not easy for her. And so I'm really proud of that for her.
That's great. That's great. Well, take us back to this time. You're a member of the church.
Yes.
You're working at NASA.
Yes.
You have three young people. Girls.
Yes.
And what happens next? How did you end up on staff at South Main? And I know some folks maybe know this story a little bit, but kind of walk us through it. And it's remarkable.
Well, I've been at NASA for 18 years at this point, and I always knew that I was not going to retire from NASA. Like, I went to work at NASA and went to work on the new program they were doing because those were the hardest things in my mind. So, but it wasn't the thing that I was going to do forever. So about 2007, I started really thinking, maybe 2006, 2007, started thinking about what the next career was going to be. At one point, I had gone back to school and was taking classes to get certified to be a teacher because I really thought that maybe I wanted to be a teacher. I love kids and I love teaching. But then I got pregnant with Lauren, and I was working full-time, and it seemed like going to school to get a degree and working full-time and having three small children was one too many things. So also loved to throw parties and had a dream that maybe I would be a party planner or something like that. And so I'd been thinking for quite some time, a year or so, like, what is the next career going to be? And really kind of started getting serious about it at around December of 2007. And so Steve and the girls are at work one day, and or the girls are at school and Steve's at work, and I decide I'm going to make this big plan for Steve. I'm going to make a spreadsheet because spreadsheets are always a great way to get Steve Rader to, like, you know, take me seriously and think that I've thought through something. So anyway, I prepared this lovely meal and I had a spreadsheet, and my plan was to convince him that I needed to take about 6 months, maybe a year off of work to kind of have a sabbatical to figure out what the next thing was that I was going to do. And so I had it all planned out, really great strategy. And he came home and had the great meal. I pulled up the spreadsheet to show him everything. And he's like, I don't think that sounds like a good idea at all. That's a terrible idea. Why don't you get a new job and then take a break? I'm like, but that's missing the whole point. Anyway, that didn't go the way I thought it would go. And then before I went to bed that night, I just said a prayer to God and said, like, I realize now that I am over-engineering this, that I have spreadsheets and I've been thinking about and analyzing this whole thing for so long. And the one thing I haven't done is shut up and listen to God's plan for me. So I go to bed, and in the middle of the night, I wake up, and my house has never been so quiet. Like, Steve wasn't snoring. There was no, like, heat or whatever. There was no noise whatsoever in my home. And I knew I shouldn't have asked God. That was a really bad idea, because right now what's happening is this. So I got up and I walked into the living room, and kind of the shorter version is God and I had a conversation. This is a Monday evening. The Sunday before, Steve had started preaching on the windows, and he had just preached the Matthew window, follow me. So when I walk into my living room and sit down and say, okay, God, I'm ready. I wasn't ready, but like, I knew this is what was happening. Follow me. You may or may not remember, but this was the time Mike Gregg had left the summer before. So Mike Gregg, as our children's minister, has been gone since maybe June. And so we're talking, like, this is the first week of January. And I just, like, knew that's what God was saying to me. And nothing has terrified me more. Like, it was the most terrifying thing that I'd ever even considered. Steve, of course, grew up very Baptist, and his parents were missionaries, and they were super Baptist. My family did not grow up Baptist. I was Catholic, christened in the church because my parents were Catholic when they were married, and then when they were divorced, of course, we changed plans. I grew up Methodist, but certainly didn't go to Sunday school every Sunday. Wednesday night wasn't a thing for us as a Methodist, and so the whole idea was just completely overwhelming. To stand up and pray, to wear a robe, to do all of those things was really more than I thought I could do. And so there was a moment in that evening where I thought, you know, nobody has to know that God and I have had this conversation. Like, I could just crawl back in bed and, like, nobody has to know. And like that thought formed. And then the next thing that formed was like, but who am I to say that I know better than God? So that was kind of it. So I went to bed and got back up the next morning, went to work. I called Steve Rader and said, hey, honey, can like we meet at lunch? Because we were both at NASA at the time. Like, can we just meet out at the pond? Because it's a beautiful campus if y'all have never been there. And I'm like, okay, this is what happened last night. And like, oh, this is what happened last night. Isn't that crazy? Like, what did we eat for dinner? It must have been awful. You know, all of these things. All of these things are in my mind like someone is going to say this was your, like, this is the craziest thing, right? And he said, yeah. You need to call Steve Wells. I'm like, no. Do not need to call Steve Wells. You were supposed to say this was a terrible idea and we were going to be done with it. Like last night. Why? Like, why can't we have no now? So then it took me 2 more days to get my courage up to call Steve Wells. Turns out I called him on a Wednesday. Didn't realize at that time that's a really busy day for the pastor. Wednesday, he's busy getting ready for things. Anyway, I called him, and we had a conversation that kind of went like, hi, Steve, this is Dolores. Oh, because I didn't talk to him on the phone very often at that time. And I said, I was thinking of all the ways that I was going to get out of this, right? So I said, I'm just wondering, like, you've probably already, like, Phil found somebody to be the children's minister by now, right? Like, you've probably already found somebody. Because if he said yes, we didn't have to have the conversation, right? And he didn't say, he said, no, we haven't. And then very jokingly, but because the Holy Spirit is exactly doing all the things the Holy Spirit needs to do, he jokingly said, why? Are you interested? Which, of course, never in a million years did he think that's why I was calling. But had he not said that, I don't know how I would have ever formulated the words. So he said it, and then I paused because I was surprised. But the pause was the thing that let him, like, and let me say the words. And again, he wasn't surprised. And then I eventually told my parents, and they weren't surprised. And I told people at work, and even they were not surprised. It's like, what is happening here? And so then we had went and talked to the personnel committee and we talked to all the other people. We had really great conversations and no one said, Dolores, it was what you ate for dinner the night before.
Well, talk to us a little bit. Here's what we're going to do. We got about 4 or 5 minutes left. What we're going to do is I'm going to jump into family ministry a little bit.
Okay.
Everyone's going to get their food. Can you stay and talk? Okay, great. But let's kind of just begin that. Like, what were the first, I mean, obviously that is it's a pretty big change to come
really big change.
From NASA to the church. And I want to kind of get up from the part where you've joined staff up to when you took your sabbatical.
Okay.
What were you doing? How did you get your feet on the ground? How did you begin to connect with what this new season in your life was like?
So long ago, y'all. 2008 is when that was. So it's almost been 12 years. I joined the staff, and they were amazing. And they're really, even though a lot of them are no longer here, they were some of the smartest people I've ever worked with. And I worked with some pretty smart people at my old job. So they were smart. They were fun to work with. They taught me so much. Amy Grizzle-Kane taught me so much. Aaron Conaway taught me so much. Steve Wells taught me so much because I knew nothing, right? Like, I knew nothing except for, like, I have always loved children and always connected to them somehow. And so that part of my job, the children's minister and being with the children and creating a space for them here was the easy part for me. And the parts that were really hard, there was this amazing team that just taught me how to do it all.
Yeah. And you're doing food and events and things like that
too.
Yeah,
it started. So I have this thing at about 5 years, stuff kind of gets the way I have dreamed it in my head, and it kind of gets a little easy. And so then I kind of get bored with it. And so I want another challenge. Back to that thing is like, I like a hard thing. So after about 5 years of doing children's ministry, Steve let me do some fellowship stuff. So a lot of the things in the kitchen, y'all remember that, or bigger events, we started doing all of that, and that became my responsibility as well.
And I think what you just said, I've noticed about that too, is that, when you feel like you've settled in and you've, in a sense, mastered something, okay, what's next? What's next on the horizon? Let's get you up to your sabbatical. What dreaming did you do before you went to your sabbatical? And, what were you thinking was going to happen? Did you kind of already have in mind what you thought the next step would be at that point?
So maybe it was early 2016 is when we knew that Kevin was going to leave. And so Steve came in and said, Dolores, is there a scenario where you would be interested in taking not only the children, but the youth? And now by this time, the girls are older and they're in there. And so I can start to kind of see. One of the things I really love thinking is strategically. And I like to think about how all the things fit together and how to integrate things. Those are like my passion points. And so I said, I would love to think about that. Because it turns out that the only two things that I didn't like about children's ministry, one was all the shopping. Like, I don't like to shop. And it turns out you have to buy a lot of things for children. But the bigger thing was when the fifth graders would leave, right? And when they would transition to the youth group. And I'm like, but I've loved them since the day they were born. And now they're out and they don't care. So, yes, I would love to think about something broader and going from 0 to 18. So that was kind of in the spring that idea was planted. And then I left in September, October, into September, early October for my sabbatical.
Talk to us a little bit about, and we've got your computer too. We've got some more pictures. So talk to us a little bit about maybe coming out of your sabbatical, but in general, maybe just start us off a little bit more about how the family ministry is built up. What are the values of the family ministry?
So while I was on sabbatical, I got to go to several really wonderful conferences. One of them was the Leadership Institute at Disney World. And there we worked on honing purpose statements and values. And so coming out of that conference, I decided on five values for the family ministry. The first is safety. The second is excellence, creativity, intentionality, and putting the right people in the right places.
And how has that directed the work that you then did? And maybe even talk to us a little bit about strategic planning like that.
Gotcha. So it was really important to me to identify those, make sure that the members of the team and our leadership identified with those, and that then we built programs around each of those. So every week in our family ministry team meetings, we talk about where we saw the values in action and when we dream of what new programming or activities or things we're going to do with the kids, we make sure that we're hitting on some, if not all, or at least not going against them. So like, for instance, last year we updated the child protection policy. It hadn't been updated since 2000 and something before I even started. Mike Gregg was still here. Hadn't been updated in that long. And if safety is going to be one of our values, then we really needed to go back and do a good job of updating that and educating all of our leadership and volunteers on that.
Yeah. So you're using those. They're not just words. You're touching on them every single week. And you say meetings. Who are you meeting with? How is the family ministry set up? Talk to us a little bit about about the players on your team and what each one's role are. And then as we do that, maybe we'll also talk about what sort of the aims and the goals of each, I guess, subset of age group is. As well. And I'm just so, it's so amazing because we also have certain values, in the church, but to be able to go back and touch those every week, I know makes a really big difference. So talk to us a little bit about the players on the team.
Sure. So, as you, have observed on your own, the number of children and families that we have has been growing over the last decade or so. And so part of when Steve came to me and said, can you envision taking over 0 to 18 and what would that look like? The first thing I came back to him was we would need a team of people to do this well. So the team of people we have... There we are. These are the members of the team, and let me tell you kind of how we broke it down. So Kate Lane, who is standing next to Suzanne, y'all know Suzanne because she's in the room. So Kate Lane right here has three children and in a previous life is worked as a registered nurse in a pediatric ER. She is responsible for mostly moms and dads of little bitties. So all of our expectant parents, our parents of 0 through 3 year olds, as well as those children, are her responsibility. It's less about programming for them and more about relationships with that age group and those parents. And Kate is really great at that. So we have 0 to 3. And then after that, we have pre-K and kindergarten, because that's our biggest area of growth right now. Those two classes are just gigantic. Kelly Barsh, who you see standing next to me on my right, is responsible for pre-K and kindergarten. Kelly has been a principal at a school. She has all of the degrees and all the amazing teacher things that you would want somebody to have. She is also responsible for hiring and training and managing all of our childcare workers, which we now have 26 childcare workers that we employ, which is doubled what it was a decade ago because we have so many more kids and families. So that's a big job that she does as well. After pre-K and K...
Well, let me stop you before you jump to the next person. Yeah. What are you trying to do with kids at that age? What are you trying to instill and let them kind of experience?
So mostly what we want them to know is that God loves them, that church is a safe place where they are known by name and adored, and some very basic things about the Bible, the Lord's Prayer. Starting with our two-year-olds, they are getting Bible lessons every single Sunday in Sunday school. And definitely by the time they're in pre-K and K, we are really digging into all of those things. So this is the beginning of laying the foundation for their discipleship really in pre-K and K.
And then what's next?
So then next is Leanne Bryant, who is on my left in this picture. Leanne has first through fourth grade. And at that point, we are doing all the things. They are learning how to serve. They are learning how to lead. Cheris helps them each week with their leadership skills and preparing them. They right now are taking Financial Peace University Junior. So great. They're doing Bible memory work. You've seen them receive their Bibles. We are going really deep in laying all that discipleship foundation for them and making sure that they really have all of those fundamentals. They do a hymn. They learn a hymn every month. It's not just Bible. It's the whole worship, discover, and share for them.
And then who's next?
After them is Hannah Rollins, who is the one with the long blonde hair. She is responsible for the 527 tribe, which is our 5th, 6th, and 7th graders. This is a really unique, I don't know anybody else that breaks their grades that way, but I'll tell you, it was one of the things I thought longest and hardest about when I was on sabbatical. And the reason it's 5th, 6th, and 7th grade is this. 6th grade for most children is middle school. If you can remember back to 6th grade or when you entered into middle school, it is, for these children especially, a very traumatic time. Everything is changing for them. I don't have my two teachers. I now have a different teacher every hour. I'm in this big place, and I've gone from being the top of the heap down to the bottom of the heap. It's just a very tumultuous and really change-filled time. And so I thought, why in the world would we make church also this big change for them. So what we do is when they finished fourth grade, going into fifth grade, they join the 527 tribe. They are confident. They know everything. Mm-hmm. They love this church. They know they're loved by this church. All of that foundation has been set. And while they're still at that point, we move them to a new building with new people and a new Sunday school and church format so that when they're in sixth grade and all of the rest of their life is changing, nothing is changing here. Miss Hipple loves me. She loved me last year. She loves me this year. Mr. Taylor, like everything stays the same for them. And then we do the same thing at seventh grade and we move them to the youth group then in eighth grade. Turns out you get pretty cocky when you're in fifth and eighth grade and you think you're ready for the next thing. So we just kind of lean into that. But even more importantly, we establish a new routine and a new plan for them.
Yeah. And then talk to us about the youth.
So the youth is really awesome. It's 8th through 12th grade. And what we're doing with our youth is we are training youth residents. So each of the people that I talked about on the team up to this point are part-time South Main Baptist Church employees. Our youth residents are full-time, and they are in a residency program that lasts 3 years. And what we do is Steve and I go search high and low at seminaries and find the very brightest that is graduating. Seminary students graduating, we bring them to South Main and we put them in this residence program. In the first year, they learn all about family ministry. They learn about why values are important and strategic planning is important and how to love on kids and how to just to pour into family ministry. And then in year two, we start to work with them to understand more broadly what it's like to be on a pastoral team, how to do budgets, how to follow a child protection policy, why it's important, not how to follow it, but why it's important and what you need to put in place. All of these things so that they know when they leave us in 3 years and go do a youth ministry for a different church, they're taking all this healthy, taking it with them and importing it to another church. And every year and a half, we bring in a new resident so that our youth are never left in this kind of quagmire place where they don't have someone that they know and love and is pouring into them. So right now, we have two youth ministry residents. You can see Brandon on the right and Tyler on the left. Brandon is in year two of the residency program, and Tyler just started this fall. They are actually at Charlie Funderburk's football game last week in the rain and the cold, because that's what they do.
Yeah, and that makes a huge difference. I mean, I took this picture after the game. They met with Charlie, and his face just lights up when he sees his youth ministers at his game. And that's happening all over the city. They're going to shows. They're going to half times for at football games to see dancers and things like that.
Yes.
And just it's just remarkable. And their mileage shows on that too. But they're just terrific, terrific people. Talk to us about like what if someone grows up here at South Main or maybe jumps in when their family moves here and they discover the church as people are doing. What do you hope they will leave when they head off to college? What do you hope for them? What will they have? What is sort of the deliverable for them?
So just like our values dictate what we do, that end goal is a lasting and authentic faith in Christ. That's our line. So again, everything we're doing is working towards that. So authentic meaning they own it themselves. It's not just the thing that Pastor Steve preached to me every week. It's not the thing that Ms. Cheris told me. It's not the thing that Ms. Dolores told me. It's not the thing my parents tell me. It is the thing that I believe and I can articulate on my own. And lasting in that, you know, not all of our seniors necessarily are to that point, but we're working on a longer horizon. And for those of them who are, if it is authentic, it will last. Does that make sense?
Yeah. And they've got, in addition to their parents, who else is kind of looking out for them?
So one of the things we work really hard on is putting a lot of different people from the church in their past. So there's research from Fuller Institute that says if you want teenagers to have a lasting and authentic faith. One of the things that helps, that statistically is proven, is that if they have five adults who are investing in them spiritually from their church, they are more likely to maintain their faith as an adult. So we're like being very literal about that, and we are looking for all kinds of opportunities to put people in their path. So you might have seen this like at the kindergarten. At the beginning of the year, we had prayer partners for each of our kindergartners and prayer partners for our seniors. Each of those partners are personally chosen for those children and the youth as someone who may invest in them for a long time and become one of those five people.
Yeah, and a ton of thought goes into that. What talk to us about the parents now. What are the parents, what are the resources a parent of a child at South Main is receiving? Just yesterday, for instance, I attended something that was a suicide prevention talk, things like that. Dishing with Dolores. Talk to us a little about the resources you're providing to parents.
So if we want our children to have an authentic and lasting faith, it can't be a drop-in Sunday morning. Here, Miss Cheris, here's my first grader, and now I'll take them home. So part of our purpose statement says a Monday through Sunday partnership or relationship we have. One of the early things that framed ministry, how I wanted to do ministry for me, was on a mission trip. We were in a van. It was a family mission trip. We were in a van, and one of the mothers, a child, said a joke. And the mother looked at the child and said, "Honey, we don't tell those kind of jokes." And I thought it was going to be a period, but it wasn't a period. It was at church. And that just struck me that it can't be just at church. It's never going to be authentic and lasting if it's only happening in this building. So if it's Monday through Sundays, we need to equip and help parents know how to do that when they're not here. Because a lot of us were not taught how to do that. And some of it has been really hard things to talk about. And a lot of families haven't had those discussions. So we're trying to normalize conversations around how to talk to your child about faith, how to talk to children about their sexual integrity, how to talk to children about healthy habits, whether those are mental health or physical health, how to talk to your children about finances. All of these things are intertwined with what our faith is and how God sees those things and how God sees us. And so it's a very natural thing to do, but it's not something, it's like worship 101. We still need some help in how to do it. Yeah. So we're trying to provide those resources.
And I want to stress, and maybe kind of get this by now, but this is not something that anybody else is doing. Like, you invented this. I mean, you've gone and got resources from different places, put them together in a unique way. What are some of the things that people with us today, senior adults, can do to help support the family ministry?
I'm so glad you asked. So I think I love it. Families love it when you recognize them, when you reach out to them and have a conversation with them. So if you're sitting next to a family in worship, like, talk to them. Talk to the kids. Talk to the parents. We all need encouragement and connection. You could write notes to them on the prayer list that are here on Wednesday nights and Sundays. There's this family ministry section. Like, if it's their birthday, oh my goodness, how cool is it if I got a note from Miss Margaret? I might not even know who Miss Margaret is in person, but the fact that people at my church, you're just reinforcing what we're telling them when you do that. They know you love them, but like overt acts. If you wanted to, something that's really on my heart right now is how we keep our kids, once they leave for college, connected to South Main. Like, we need to send notes. So you'll see, like, right now, and it's been on there for a while, it's our college freshmen right? So they're off in this new world, and they need to stay connected, tethered to y'all. So notes to them. If you ever wanted to make cookies and drop them off, I would make sure it got to them if you wanted to write a note. Just all the things that you do to stay connected. One of the other big research points that I found that really struck me was multi-generational church is another big factor that determines whether a child will stay connected to their faith as they grow older. So y'all are that. So do not be afraid of them. Don't think you're bothering them or bugging them. Every time you talk to a parent or to a child or reach out to them in any way, that is a really wonderful thing that you're underscoring what church is.
Yeah. And we've got two or three minutes. I have two more questions. Okay. One is, what do you sort of envision the future of family ministry being like? I know, and maybe say just a word about numbers too, that we have seen such growth, that really family ministry is what's driving the growth of the church. Talk to us about the future and maybe a bit about the numbers.
Okay. So right now we've had so much change and so many things that we're putting in place. What I really want to see is all of it solidify. I want people to start inviting other families because we offer the things with excellence and creativity that we offer. So that yesterday we had 30 people come and hear a professional speak to us about how to look for signs of depression or suicidal thoughts, like that continues to grow, that those resources become stronger and really more of a hallmark, and that our kids keep doing what they're doing, just more. I think we've got a really good foundation for all of them. Right now, we have 230 kids and 115 families at South Main Baptist Church with 0 to 18-year-olds. And they live all over. We have 13 different school districts, not schools, but school districts, 22 high schools that Brandon and Tyler are driving all of. When he says he's putting miles on the car, they are going all over the city. We have a family that lives in Liberty. We have families that live in the Woodlands. We have families that live in Katy, and we have families that live in Friendswood. So it is a huge swath, and it's a big effort, and it takes a lot of time and energy to get here and make the commitment they are, but they are doing it. It's really amazing.
My last question, I when I tell people, when I invite people to the church, especially those that have families, I say, you've got to meet Dolores. And so she's gifted at process and strategic planning, but she's also got this incredible empathy and sympathy and love for kids, which I think are two different gifts, literally right brain and left brain. Do you understand kind of how rare that is, and where do you think that comes from in you that you can do both those things?
I have no answer for that. I think, like, we're all born with whatever God gives us, and that's the norm for us. Like, I don't know. It's just, I don't know. I don't have a good answer for that.
You have that, and it's really remarkable. And I just want to say thank you for sharing, and also for all the work that you've done, the love that you show our kids, and it's just, it's incredible. And we've just really seen the church grow from your work and from your ideas and from God's giftedness to you and your faithfulness to God. So thank you.